Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I'm André Sapir, senior fellow at Bruegel, and today we are here for an installment of the Bruegel Backstage series, focusing on the EU-Japan economic agreement. Joining me today is Professor Nakamura from Kobe University and Maria Arsenius, Head of Cabinet of Trade Commissioner Malmström. We are going to talk about the EU-Japan economic partnership agreement, what it means in the context also of today's changing trade relation and geopolitical matters. Let me first turn to you, Professor Nakamura. The agreement between the governments of Japan and of the EU member states was signed this summer. It is expected that the agreement will be ratified by the European Parliament and by the Japanese Parliament during the autumn, by December at the latest, and that the agreement will enter into force early next year. From your perspective, what does this agreement mean?
Okay, I think this is a kind of landmark agreement, right? Including the FTA part as well as the other intellectual property right parts. So we are very happy with this agreement, EPA. And also, this could be a very, very good negotiation asset for the for Japanese government negotiating with other countries like US, right? So we are very happy with that.
Maria, from a European perspective, I'm asking you the same question. What is for the European Commission, for the EU, what is the meaning of this agreement? What are the potential implications?
I think it is important both economically and politically. Economically, it will be important as it will facilitate trade between us. And I'm proud that this is the biggest bilateral trade agreement that the EU has ever signed with anybody, representing EU and Japan together more than a quarter or almost a third of world GDP. And we will facilitate trade this way by taking away tariffs, but also opening for services and for public procurement contracts in our respective economic areas. We will have some regulatory cooperation that we can cooperate to set international standards together. And just maybe a small thing, but something I really care a lot about in this agreement is it's the first time we have a special chapter to facilitate for small and medium-sized enterprises, SMEs. And I think that's really good, and that's something we should have in all agreements in the future. Because it's so difficult for SMEs to benefit from trade, because just to get the right information about what rules apply is a big obstacle for SMEs trading internationally. And there is a huge potential here, since so many companies are SMEs, and they are the ones who tend to grow the most and employ more people. So I think this is also the way that we can also increase employment more than otherwise.
So both Japan and the European Union already have many agreements with many other countries. But I think it's fair to say that this agreement is indeed, as you said, Professor Nakamura, a landmark agreement. I think it's both a landmark from what we just heard from Maria Arsenius, the breadth of the agreement and the novelty of some of the clauses. But it's also the fact that indeed, for each other, it's the biggest partner with whom we ever signed an agreement. Japan had agreement with others, but never with such a large market as a partner as the EU, and vice versa for the EU with Japan. So yes, I think we agree, or you both agree that this is a landmark agreement. Now, what are the features here do you see as being really important in today's world?
Apart from the economic benefits, it sends also a very strong political signal that we believe trade is a good thing. Mm-hmm. It is a win-win. Both sides will benefit. And that is an important signal in a world where trades in some quarters are increasingly questioned and some people seem to think that if I win, you have to lose. But actually, both sides can win from this. And I think that's also a very important signal to send in this political climate that we live in today.
Yeah, I agree with that. And as Maria said, that this agreement, including the MNU, right, small and medium-sized SME, small and medium-sized enterprise, right? Most of FTA looking at the large companies in international trade, but as you know, Japan is suffer from the kind of labor shortage. So the small and medium-sized enterprise are very worrying about shortage of labor. So I think that this is very good things to including the SME or medium and small-sized enterprise agreement.
No. You are both seeing the virtues of this agreement, and we at Bruegel actually we published today a study that we did with two colleagues for the European Parliament, where we made an assessment of the agreement, and we also come to very positive assessment of the agreement, both indeed from an economic and from a broader, let's say, political perspective. So one question that I'm asking myself is how come we are not observing, I'm first asking you that to you, Maria, in Europe, how comes we are not observing with the EU-Japan agreement the kind of backlash that we had observed during the negotiations with the United States? There was quite a bit of backlash, and even at some point towards the end of the negotiations with Canada, there was an anti-CETA movement in Europe. Somehow we have not seen that. I've not seen demonstrations either in Brussels or in some of the European capitals. Why do you think that the political reaction to the EU-Japan agreement is so different from the reactions to those two other discussions, EU-US and EU-Canada?
Mm. Yes, our negotiations on TTIP, they were regarded with a fair amount of skepticism from people who thought that this would be only benefiting big business. And there was a lot of anti-Americanism around, especially in some member countries, notably Germany, which is maybe strange because Germany is one of the countries that really depends on exports and that is doing very well. But I remember, I don't know if you remember anymore, but the fact that the Americans had listened to Chancellor Merkel's GSM caused a huge backlash in Germany. And there was a lot of anti-Americanism around. And the Canada agreement, I think, came under criticism only because Canada is a neighbor to the US. So it was labeled TTIP through the back door. Otherwise, I don't think that would have been controversial at all. Japan is not seen as such a big threat because it's a developed country, very similar to our own economy. So that helps. And I also think that a little bit is also due to the fact that we have changed our policy since Commissioner Malmström entered the Commission and took over trade policy. She has made it more transparent to show that we are not sitting in secret back rooms doing secret deals. We publish a lot of texts and we are more inclusive. We talk with people in a different way, experts, but also civil society, NGOs, parliaments, even regional parliaments. And I think that also helps a bit.
I would tend to agree that today's agreements, also by their breadth, the fact that they deal with a lot of regulatory matters, implies that one does need to involve not just the usual trade experts, but one need to involve society on a wider scale. Now, a slightly different question about Japan. If I understand correctly, one of the motivations from the Japanese government and from Prime Minister Abe for this agreement, and in general for pushing free trade agreements is also to use them as a means to implement a number of reforms. It's part of this package of the third arrow. Would you can you explain a little bit to our listeners in what manner this trade agreement, the EU-Japan, and maybe broader, you know, Japan agreement with other countries, are a part of the economic strategy of Abenomics?
Yes. As you mentioned, Abenomics constitute three arrows, right? The most important arrow is the third one. It's a competitiveness, right? So EU and Japan are kind of very similar similar economies, right? So if Japan penetrated the EU market very successfully, which shows Japanese competitiveness, right? And also, Japanese used to be look at the world through the American eyes, right? So then most Japanese think that Europe is far away and we can't do nothing with Europe. But that throughout the process of the negotiation or bargaining, most Japanese came to realize that Europe and the EU is a very, very important partner. I think that is a kind of very important side effect of this agreement. Okay, so as you said, Abe want to facilitate increase the Japanese competitiveness throughout the world. So the Europe market is a kind of the first place to implement his third arrows.
Okay. So far the discussion has focused on the two actors, the EU and Japan, of this bilateral agreement. Let's broaden a little bit the discussion and bringing the United States and China, the other two giants of the world economy. Let's first talk about the United States. Both Japan and the EU have been close partners, economic, political partner of the United States, certainly since World War II. And we are very much intertwined, both Japan and the EU with the US the US economy. And now in the last few months, the relationship with the United States has been quite tense, with the United States and President Trump taking unilateral measures on steel, possibly on cars, and obviously the measures vis-à-vis China, that is very much a focus of attention for President Trump. So I want to ask you both, in what manner the change of attitude of the United States, that used to be the champion of the multilateral trading system, and has moved towards not only bilateral, but even unilateral action, and at times quite aggressive. In what manner is the EU-Japan agreement a response to the kind of attitude that President Trump has been having, and the threats to both to the system and to both the EU and to Japan in terms of their trade relation with the United States?
Okay, as you know, Japan don't want the bilateral negotiation between US and Japan, especially Japan don't want the US-Japan FTA, right? But so if this agreement will be in effect, right? In such a case, Japan can use this is a very important negotiation or threat or even a threat point for the in the bargaining process. So we are very happy with having this agreement, and we hope that this agreement will be in effect soon.
Is the EU in a similar situation, Maria?
Well, I know that negotiations between the EU and Japan started many, many years ago, but I think they accelerated after President Trump moved into the White House, because then we saw even more clearly how important it was for us to have this agreement between us. And yes, I also hope that it will enter into force now very quickly, hopefully 1st of February already.
Mm-hmm. What about China? Was China a bit the elephant in the room Was it also present, you think, in the mind of the negotiators? Because indeed, as you said, the EU-Japan negotiations started before President Trump.
That was part of the picture as well. But right now, I think a problem with the unilateral measures and all the noise that is emanating from the United States, I think one problem with that is, apart from the fact that many of the measures are WTO incompatible and shouldn't be taken therefore, but it also that it takes away attention from the real issues that we should focus on, and that is to reform the international rules-based system that we have. It has given us so many benefits over decades. But I agree that with President Trump, actually, that the current rule book may not be good enough, and that we need to working now on new rules that is better adapted to this world. And many of the tensions that we see today in the global trading environment is caused by China's big growth and the way they are growing, what I would like to call level playing field issues. We have a really an increasing problem with the vast industrial subsidies that China is giving to various sectors. And the state-owned enterprises in China, their weight is not diminishing, but rather growing. And we have forced technology transfers and politicization of company boards, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something we really have to come to grips with. And this is what we should talk about rather than lashing out with, you know, WTO incompatible measures against each other. But therefore, I'm also very grateful or happy or congratulate Japan on the initiative that Japan took last year to actually start organizing trilateral meetings between the EU, Japan and the US to talk about exactly these things. I think we are doing very important work there because it is in all our interest and also in China's interest to have well-functioning multilateral rules.
So, Professor Nakamura, we just heard that there is indeed this trilateral process, Japan, EU, US, that is discussing reform of the WTO, but really how to adapt the rules to the situation that China, that China's membership and China's behavior in some areas is creating. And I think this is clearly a positive development. I know that from the EU side, in addition to this trilateral process, there is also a bilateral process between the EU and China. I think to try to help smooth this relationship and try also to convince China that it is in its own interest as well to reform some of the rules and, you know, to discuss those matters in Geneva. So I wanted to ask you from a Japanese perspective, how are at the moment the relationship between Japan and China? And do you think that China can also be convinced in its bilateral discussion with Japan of the necessity to sit down in a multilateral framework and try to update, to reform the WTO rules in a manner that should be obviously of the interest of all the parties. But do you think that Japan is involved in such discussion with China? And in what manner do you think that Japan can contribute to this goal, which is to have multilateral negotiations for a 21st century rules-based multilateral system?
Oh, that is a very tough question for me, right? The economical role, Chinese economical role for Japan is changing past 20 years, right? First, Japan moved to the production facility to China, right? So China is a kind of a center of the production in East Asian regions. But now is China is a huge market, right? A lot of tourists comes from China now. So these days, most Japanese think that China is a most important market for Japan, right? So in such a case, now Japan is reluctant to commit those kind of process because most Japanese enterprise and average people don't want to lose a Chinese market, right? So that is a very important issue. So hopefully I would like to Japan will commit multilateral negotiations among China, US, EU, and also other East Asian countries as well, right?
So you're saying that this trilateral setup and maybe that could one day be enlarged to have discussions with China is more comfortable with Japan than this a bilateral discussion between Japan between Japan and
especially
and China.
South Korea also interested in the China's market, right? So trilateral framework is better than bilateral, but multilateral, including other East Asian countries, I think it is necessary.
Can you tell us something about what is the thinking in Japan about free trade agreement between Japan and China, possibly together with other countries, you know, the RCEP initiative other initiatives that exist in East Asia. What is the thinking in Japan about that?
I think the most Japanese people are not happy with those kind of FTA or free trade areas because competition is not fair, right? And I don't know exactly what's happening in China, but most Japanese people think that we can't trade under the fair environment. So that is a kind of the big issues in Japanese talking now.
So Maria, let me turn to you and ask you a last question. We are now less than a year, or roughly a year before the end of this Juncker Commission. What do you think for this most important issue, which is reform of the WTO, the role of China, obviously high interest to both the EU and Japan, and obviously the President Trump attitude? What do you think that in this very complicated chess game, right, which is both a multilateral chess game, a bilateral chess game between the EU and the US, between the EU and Japan, the EU and China, trilateral. So this is an extremely complicated game, but a very important one. What do you think can be achieved in the months or less than a year, essentially, that remain for this commission?
Yeah, I certainly hope that we will be able to agree on a few new rules in the WTO. And I think the most advanced area right now where we are really writing new legal text in the commission is on industrial subsidies. I think we will table texts during this autumn. And I also hope that we will be able to make progress on forced technology transfers. But apart from, and other new rules, but apart from writing new rules, we also have to be better at enforcing the current ones. For example, every WTO member is supposed to notify the WTO about subsidies it is giving. And there China is not doing what it should. So that's something that we have to increase transparency, because it's difficult for us to fight against subsidies if we don't know that they exist. And we also have to work on the very important other pillar in the WTO, namely to unblock the problems we have now with the appellate body, the dispute settlement system, where we are kind of running out of judges as the old one retires and US is blocking new names. So we have so many important things to do, and I hope that we can keep building momentum for reforms in all these bilateral, trilateral, but also multilateral contexts. We have to work with other countries, like-minded countries, but also the wider membership in the WTO.
Thank you. So this brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for listening to Bruegel Backstage on the Sound of Economics channel. And thank you to my guests, Marie Arsenius and Professor Nakamura. If you are interested in more Bruegel's work, we have an array of blog posts and publications available on our website, www.bruegel.org. I hope you will join us again. Until next time, bye-bye.